We should have a dash one amendment for this. Do we have that?
Yep.
Can you tell us, Harrison, what this bill's about?
I'll give it a try. The bill as drafted establishes an additional game mammal season for wildlife units when annual limit on game mammals is not reached during the general season. It establishes the tag cost at 4 times the cost of the general season tag. We do, as you say, have the dash one amendments, and the dash one amendments replace the substantive changes in the bill. What they do is they delete the operative language and then allow tags in an undersubscribed controlled hunt drawing to be made available to licensed hunters at up to 4 times the standard tag fee. So we change from wildlife units to undersubscribed tags in a controlled hunt.
Okay, Representative King, this is your bill, 3381. And we have Rich Berry and Rod Harder signed up. Rich, do you want to come on? Come on up, too. We don't want to spend a lot of time on this. We have some dash one amendments here in front of us. Can you tell us what the issue is here and why we need this bill?
Thank you, Chairman and Al King, District 44, and it's a pleasure of mine to bring this bill forward. It came to my attention that we do have some declining participation in hunting in some areas, that we have a pretty significant potential decrease in revenue for ODF&W from licensing sources. And at the same time, I think that the ODF&W does an excellent job in trying to be good stewards of dealing with wildlife issues and working with our hunting population. I think that there's a substantial population out there that are what I would call motivated hunters. They really enjoy doing it. They invest in some equipment. At the same time, they might be limited to one hunt, during the year. And that if we are having some situations where some hunting units are not fully subscribed to meet their biological objectives, that why not allow a motivated hunter to pay a little higher fee and be able to take up that slack, that it would give ODF&W another management tool and also gives them a tool that they could use for additional revenue. At the same time, we wanted to make sure that if we did raise the fees, we weren't raising the fees so it was just a revenue item. We weren't trying to create trophy hunts for high net worth individuals that only the rich could afford. We wanted to keep it well within the pricing range of the typical person that would enjoy that sport. And so the thought came forward to offer a second hunting season for a motivated hunter where there is undersubscribed participation in a unit, and that also, for the record, part of the objective here is to give ODF&W some flexibility in terms of how to do that. The amendment there is clearly a friendly one to help the agency be able to to accomplish the objectives and at the same time work within what they're trying to accomplish. And so I'd like to let Mr. Harder speak, if that's okay.
Okay, go ahead. And, Rod and,
Chair Wells, committee members, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, Executive Director of Oregon Sportsman's Defense Fund, and we are here this morning in support of this bill. The amendments clear up most of the problems that we had with it. The amendments say that this will only take place in a controlled hunt unit with the tags that are left over after the drawing. And so we're not exceeding quotas in any way. We're not exceeding management objectives or levels. But, for instance, if in a unit there were 100 tags, and on the original drawing 75 of those tags were used, and on the second drawing there were some left over, those leftover tags will be available at 4 times the cost of the original tag. There is a possibility it would give a perception if you have enough money you can hunt, but in those units where those tags are left over, they're not terribly attractive units anyway, or the tag wouldn't be left. So we would support this. It would be an additional revenue source for Fish and Wildlife without impacting the resource in a negative way.
Can you tell, for the benefit of the committee, tell us how this works, the drawing, and why there would be tags left over? Say in a unit there's 100, why wouldn't all 100 those 100? There wouldn't be enough applications, is that the reason?
Mr. Chair, I would defer that to Mr. Berry from Fish and Wildlife, who knows the intricacies of that. But you're very close to, these would be, my experience has been where there are leftover tags, they are in fairly unpopular units, either units that have a low bull cow ratio or have difficult hunting conditions or such as that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson and Representative Hill.
Why the four-time cost? I mean, most of the time these hunting units are established for somewhat biological reasons and controlled animals, and if you haven't reached the amount of hunters that you want in there to remove those animals, I mean, I understand you want the money, but I thought the object was is to be able to actually harvest those.
Chair Wells, Representative Thompson, that's easily answered. This would be a second opportunity. In other words, you could have two tags rather than one tag. It would be a second, and you're paying a premium for the ability to hunt twice.
Okay.
Also, Al King here, that this doesn't have the same economy of scale. There's maybe a little bit more work involved with fewer people, so there might be a little bit more expense. This was the fee that ODF&W, felt would be applicable. And also, it's part of my intent that also we're trying to meet a, like Representative Thompson said, we're trying to meet a biological objective here. And so, from my mind, if we're underdrawn on the tags, that's one way that we don't reach the biological objective. But if for some reason we didn't have hunting success in an area that, that met an objective, that we would want to have the flexibility of ODF&W to, to be able to get to that point using this additional tool.
Representative Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Could you define what a unit is?
Chair Wells, Representative Hill, again, I would defer. I can do that, but I would defer for Fish and Wildlife. They're basically geographical sections that the state has set management levels for various animals, and the state's cut up into sections.
Why don't you go ahead, Representative Barr.
I've got a number of questions, I think, probably for Mr. Berry. Maybe he should...
Why don't let him go ahead and testify.
Representative Wells, members of the committee, my name is Rich Berry. I'm the Wildlife Division Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I might just say Mr. Harder's done an excellent job of answering the questions, really, that you posed to him. I might just say the unit is correct. It's just a geographic area where we have set a population harvest level, and then we have what's called a controlled hunt process in many of those where applicants may apply. Some of those can be very low numbers of tags actually authorized. We may have a very high number of people who will want to hunt that area because it may be trophy-type animals that can be taken. We also have some other areas where, due to large population size, amount of damage going on, et cetera, that we may offer a large number of tags, and yet the unit may not be the most desirable for a number of people to go to. So we will end up with some units where the tags will not be subscribed to, and we have go through what's called a second drawing. Again, we may end up with tags not all being allocated out. What Representative King has proposed here, we have been starting to take a look at the system to see how we can accommodate some people who miss the drawings or that sort of thing. I think a key component of this is says up to four times. So I think there's some things that we can do trying to encourage some hunter participation in some of these areas that may be current fee or up to four times the fee, depending on how what the unit is and what the participation might be. So we look at this as a friendly tool that we may have to work with as we review our system.
Thank you. I've got a series of questions. So I'm familiar with some of the units, like the mule for mule deer, the Columbia River Basin, the Metolius area, places like that. Is that pretty much what we're talking about here? Are there other units across the state?
Representative Beyer, the state essentially has a unit throughout the state, and it can depend on whether the unit be for an elk. The management units are essentially the same. The hunts may be different in them, but the state, essentially the entire state, is divided almost on, there are counties, but we have them divided up into hunt units.
if I could add also that, you know, there's many different styles of hunt, so that there's, you know, rifle, there's farm, there's black powder, there's archery, and, you know, in many cases currently you have to pick, you know, one place that you're at, the east side or west side, and so that, you know, there's limitation that way. This could expand that possibility.
Okay. What about, I mean, would this be a season that is after the general season, combined with, or because I'm concerned about that, if you're putting out a, you know, let's talk about the Metolius unit, for example, and which is rarely, if ever, filled, would then that person be able to go out and hunt in a rut for mule deer, which would be an extremely attractive tag, but at the same time could overpopulate the large mature bucks unit?
Representative Byer, that is not our intent. I don't believe that is the intent of anyone. It would be within existing seasons that we have, and it would just provide additional opportunity, potentially, if a hunter wanted to take two animals, they would may have that opportunity, depending on what we ended up with. But we would not envision this to go outside of existing seasons, regardless of whether they be deer, elk, or bow hunters, or muzzle loaders, or rifle seasons.
And Al King here, it was clear the intent to not go outside the biological constraints.
Okay. Other questions?
Well,
currently, you use a second chance draw to try to fill these tags, which is a for the person who either don't get their tags, or, you know, for some reason, maybe they forgot to apply or forgot to buy or something like that, they have a second chance draw. How would this affect that?
Representative Byers, one of the things we're looking at is just internally is with the second chance of should we continue doing with that? Should we potentially just say once we finish the first hunt draw, it becomes a, with our point of sale system that we now have, it may be a first come, first serve. There's some things we got to look at in doing that, but that may, whether it be the first draw, second draw, we always have some people who forgot for whatever reason to do things. So we're trying to look at after we go through that first draw, what may be the, I'll call it the most user-friendly for hunters to have all opportunity to participate in getting those tags that we're not subscribed to during the first draw. There's a number of alternatives I think we need to be talking with our various organizations that we deal with once we have some a straw man essentially to look at the options.
A couple more?
Time is moving, yes.
Well, what about in the case of one of the many places the state that is under subscribed for tags is where there's a lot of private land available, or oh, that's the only reason to hunt. Would this virtually allow private landowners in those areas to buy the unused tags and then resell them as a, you know, so that it becomes, I guess, more of a private hunting reserve thing where the person gets their own tags and issue them who they want?
Representative Wells, yes, I would not necessarily see that, but I think we could take care of that through administrative rules if that's what we saw was happening. Private landowners certainly have other mechanisms with landowner preference tags and damage complaints to solve some of the damage, and we would continue to look for that with most of the private landowners, not that it would just provide additional opportunity for them to go to a fee hunting basis.
And then one more. Right now you also have regional tags to try to use up these unused tags. Is that not popular? If people don't apply for this, you know, where you can go get a regional tag for the whole Columbia Basin or the whole mid-state region?
Chair Wells, Representative Byer, we still have unused tags with the current process.
I think with that, we're in work session. I'd like to have need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3381.
Anyone in discussion? Anyone opposed? So moved. Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3381 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
As amended
with the dash one amendment.
Any discussion on the motion? Matthew, I'd like to call the roll, please.
Chair Wells?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Becker?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Yes.
Aye. Bill 3381 has been moved to the floor. Representative King, I carry your bill. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. With that, I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2564. We have Representative Simmons and Representative Westland. Come on up. We have, Mr. Chair, this is the As is well known around this building, the notorious canned hunt bill. We have some dash one.
Dash three, dash ones
that came from Representative Simmons' office dealing with federal estate projects. We have some dash threes. We have some dash fours. And we have some dash fives.
Mr. Chair, we have something we're going to hand out today, which has a copy of the dash twos and fives. You received in your packet the one, three, and six.
Say that again, Representative Harris. Dash two, you said?
That's certainly a promotion for me. Mr. Chair, members, in your measure packet, you received the dash ones, the dash threes, and the dash fours. I think we're handing out currently dash twos and dash fives. I'm happy to discuss those with you. And I've taken I've made an effort to engross this with a little computer program. There's a lot of detail in here, and it may take us a little time, even with the engrosser, but we can work through this.
We all have a copy of that engrossed one.
I think that's coming your way now also.
Okay. The dash ones dealt with approval of federal and state projects. That addressed, Representative Simmons. That was the bill dealing with the Starkey. Mm-hmm. The dash threes came to us after our last hearing. And then we had dash fours, which exempted hunting reserve effective the date of 99, and then the dash fives, a hunting reserve that was established before 99. And then we have the dash fives, which changes that date to January 1, 99, and had some amendments that the wildlife, Fish and Wildlife brought to us. Addressing permitting requirements and licenses that are required. But there's still, and then we have also a problem with the dash fives because it addressed the wrong statute.
Mr. Chair.
President Hill.
Just so I understand, in terms of the hand engrossed version, includes the dash ones, twos, threes, and fives?
Yes.
It addresses everything we have.
And then the four and five are alternatives to each other. They would both exempt a private preserve existing as of a date certain. Before the date certain is the effective date of this legislation, that is 90 days after session. In the five, the effective date of a grandfathered unit would have to have been in business on January 1, 1999. In addition to that, the dash five has specific language which says that a private preserve that is grandfathered in must explicitly be in compliance with wildlife laws and permitting requirements.
But we have a wrong statute reference. I believe that 497-248 refers to game birds preserves. I'm saying so. That has to be taken out.
Do you want me to try to lead us through this?
Well, I have a copy of that. We have one more copy of the hand engrossed.
Looks like we do.
Maybe I have it here somewhere.
It's coming.
Here I have it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
President Decker.
If I might, just for clarity's sake, the dash one takes out federal and state projects, Starkey. The dash three is new language with game or exotic mammals, similar to the Wyoming statute on this issue. The dash four would grandfather in existing preserves. And then the dash five's intent is to, if we did decide to grandfather, which there are questions, it would say that those preserves have to fall under the same laws and permits that ODFW currently has.
It also changes that date on the grandfather.
I haven't seen the dash five.
Mr. Chair, should have been handed out on the front page of the dash two.
Representative Hill?
I'm trying to understand in terms of if the dash fours are adopted instead of the dash fives, by adopting the dash fours, that in no way would preclude in terms of anyone from having the appropriate licenses. Is that correct? So in terms of, so I'm just trying to understand the language that's added in the dash fives is.
Yeah, the Fish and Wildlife came and.
Feel good language.
They had some concerns with the dash fours because it didn't talk about if we're going to grandfather in that they must have permitted requirements and licenses if we're going to grandfather them in. So we added then a dash five that language.
But Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, in the absence of that language, would not preclude in terms of the requirements under the law to have the appropriate licenses. Is that a correct statement?
That's true, but this was just a clarifying statement they wanted in here.
I understand. So in the category of feel good language, since it, in the absence of it, they still would have to have the permit.
That's true.
Thank you.
It was to amplify that issue.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Thompson.
Could I ask that specific question of the Department of Fish and Wildlife?
They'll be up here. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is the question that's coming around, and I'd like to have that question answered by them rather than
come on
just
up.
Since it's there.
I work with Joe Rolleder on that language. So.
Okay. Is Representative Thompson, for the record, my name is Rich Berry, Wildlife Division Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
The question is this feel-good language, or does this put a tighter parameter on?
Representative Thompson, I haven't seen the language in Division 5, but it, from what you read to us, I would say is consistent to the language we are going to provide to our commission earlier or later this month.
Chair, in that case, would you mind if I give you the language and let you look at it, and then he can bring a comment back in his testimony to the
president? Right, all the dash five.
I think Representative Westland and Representative Simmons will go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Representative Ben Westland, District 55, Central Oregon. I am here to testify in strong support of and strong opposition to House Bill 2564.
This is normal.
Mr. Chair, I am the fence. I walk it very well. In short, you have a wonderful opportunity to craft some common sense legislation that would make illegal the abomination of true canned hunts where animals are chained, caged, or otherwise put in inhumane situations, where literally in extreme cases they are backed up to pens and stock trailers and released for their imminent deaths in a shooting gallery type situation. And yet at the same time you have the opportunity to preserve the fair chase principle and managed hunts. And let's be frank about this. I'm speaking specifically with regard to Clark Couch's operation in Jefferson County. Mr. Clark Couch has for over 40 years run the only Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife licensed fee hunt operation in the state. He has run it very professionally, and it is an excellent example of how fee hunts properly licensed can be run in a humane and competitive situation, embodying the fair chase principle, allowing the animal every opportunity to escape his would-be pursuer. And I would challenge any member of this committee to walk Mr. Couch's operation and not feel the effects of such an exercise. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Representative Mark Simmons. I am House District 58, Northeast Oregon, and trying to catch up here a little bit with the amendments. I had intended on coming down here today and testifying in opposition to the bill. However, I would like some clarification on The dash three amendments, line 10, would now read tied, staked, or caged. Is that correct?
Yes.
How is caged going to be defined for the purposes of this legislation?
As far as I know, Representative, we don't have any definition of that.
Would this legislation then preclude, I would defy anybody here to go out and hunt a black-tailed deer, which happens to be an indigenous species to Oregon, on a 40-acre piece of ground. If he doesn't want you to see him, you're not going to see him. And especially if you go out after him with archery equipment or a muzzleloader, even within a 40-acre enclosure, I think you find what would be a very challenging experience. And so I think what we have here is a private property right that could potentially be infringed upon by this piece of legislation, and I do have some concerns about that. So I wanted to come here today and express those concerns, and I'll need to digest this and see how this would affect a person's future ability to open an operation, say 40, 80 acres of thick coastal brush, if they chose to do so.
Okay, thank you. Is that it? Any questions from the committee? Our Representative Hill?
In the, I don't know which one amendments, but in terms of what we're doing here is we're exempting out the federal and state projects, so the Starkey experiment project, whatever it's referred to as, and then we fail to define caged. I guess, which would then leave cage to be defined through administrative rule, where they could define it as, you know, a 5x5 pen or a, you know, 2,000 acre fenced area. I guess sort of in the world of making things fair, if we were to eliminate the line that gave the outright exemption for federal and state projects and left it to the commission to define cage, would that be a better way to address the problem? So in terms of, at a minimum, I'm assuming that they would not define cage to be their Starkey project. You know, versus, I mean, and I think in terms of give some more realistic approach to caged versus, you know, a fenced-in area. I mean, I'm trying to get an understanding here in terms of what you might feel. I mean, you know, as a legislator.
Sure. Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, I would be more comfortable if there was a definition. We have under Section 1 some definitions here. I would like to, if we're going to proceed with this, hear some discussion of further amending the bill, further amendments being developed, and adding a definition of what caged is. Tied or staked, I think it's fairly easy to understand, but cage could be somewhat subjective.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Oberlong. Are you done, Representative Oberlong?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two comments. First of all, we would have to give authority in this bill to Fish and Wildlife to make rules if we are leaving things undone. Second of all, I can tell you that I can't think of a court that would ever say caged was 40 or 80 acres. Courts give definite words, common sense definitions, what's in the dictionary. I mean, I can't even begin to think of anyone who would think of a cage as being 40 or 80 acres. So I really don't see the issue with this. Cage has a meaning to most of us. So I guess I don't know where the problem is.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. If you're looking at cage, Representative Simmons, I'm also concerned about the word confinement on line 12 as a handing bill. What is the definition of being released from confinement? That's the same ambiguous language, and I also object to this bill on the grounds that we are going to preserve or grandfather in a ranch that is a professionally run ranch now in Central Oregon area, but at the same time we would prevent anyone else in the same area from starting another similar operation. And I just don't see the fairness there, where I own a ranch not too far from Mr. Couch's ranch, and similar in size, similar in terrain. Now all of a sudden he has the ability to have that, and if I so choose to do that with my property, I'd be prevented from doing that.
Are you done, Representative Byron?
I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simmons, your point is well taken about if someone were to open or wanted to open a facility such as the Couch facility on the coast. I have hunted elk on the coast in extraordinarily thick brush, and it is a most unpleasant experience, and you don't see anything because they know where to go and you don't, and you can't follow them. I also share Representative Byers' concerns that I think our goal here, from what I'm hearing, is that no one approves of this concept of caging or staking animals. That's a reprehensible idea. I think probably where we're going with this is what is appropriate in terms of an area given geographic or geological conditions or what the terrain makeup is, what's appropriate in terms of the size. I think we can avoid the caged issue if we make some allowances for either size or terrain or something of this nature. And I don't think we can do that in statute. I think we have to empower either the commission or ODF&W to make that on a per call basis. I mean, you put 40 acres of thick coastal brush, and you're going to have a hard time finding anything in there, as opposed to 1,200 acres over in Jefferson County that may be very steep, very very difficult terrain to hunt that I've hunted in. So I think we have to do something that either addresses acreage issues or something of that nature, or give the commission or the ODF&W the authority to define that if we're going to be successful ultimately in what we're trying to achieve.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Decker.
I don't want to proceed, and maybe this would be my testimony if we're just kind of discussing the bill in general, but a month ago, so this is not a new concept on the table, and we took the approach in the -3 amendment, line 15, of going at it as other Western states have to make a statement, and go line 15 through 17 deals with those exact questions to make some sort of a statement, which numerous other Western states have. This is based on Wyoming statute, which are similar terrain states. Also, my testimony is editorials from the Oregonian, the Albany Statesman Journal, and the Eugene Register Guard speaking about this practice. And the only other thing that I might reference is Representative Uberlaw's point in terms of caged, because within large acreage, there is the possibility and the probability, because it's a fee-paying enterprise where there is an incentive for profit, to make sure that the hunter gets an animal, and you can do that through feeding and other ways to assure, and I would say you're probably a good businessman, there's 500 ranchers in Texas, that they do achieve their goal of ensuring that the animals that they're looking for are close to where they would want to find them.
We have quite a few people signed up to testify here, so we need to move along. Is that it?
Just one comment. I think, actually two issues. One, I think the true issue here is the definition of caged and confinement, and I wish I shared Representative Uberlau's enthusiasm for the interpretation of the courts. I'm not so worried about the courts. I'm worried about the definition being changed in administrative rule. If you could put something in the bill to put a common sense definition in there, I think that would be appropriate. And the other thing with regard to Representative Byers' concern, I too object to the bill if it's simply a grandfathered bill. I use Clark Couch's operation as an example of how these hunts can be professionally and humanely managed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just in follow-up, I would object to the line 15A in the Hand Engrossed Amendment, and which is basically would preclude any other operator who wanted to use his property for an enterprise such as Clark Couches operating in Central Oregon area. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I think I'll bring up Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Rich Berry and Dan Edwards. Have you seen all the amendments and the hand engrossed version of this bill?
Chair Wells, for the record, I'm Rich Berry with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Director of the Wildlife Division. I believe, yes, we have now seen all the amendments to the bill. Within our comments, we have raised two issues. One was kind of the ones dealing with such issues as the Starkey unit, which we believe that has been adequately corrected. And then we also saw Dash 5, which Representative Thompson just gave us. That would be consistent with the language that we are going to be presenting to our commission. For your information, along with our statement, I have given you the information that is going to our commission. And maybe just to back up a little bit, following your hearing, our commission has also heard this same subject and is considering rules on the hunting of exotic animals. And hunting is what we have authority over. It was a very long meeting in Pendleton. The commission did not make a final vote at that point in time based on one issue that they wanted some further consideration of. And what they had asked staff to do was to go back and say, if there was a grandfather, what would that language look like and how would it apply? And a specific concern to the commission was that the activities that would be grandfathered would be only those activities which were lawfully able to be done under existing statutes, whether that was hunting or whether that was holding of exotic animals. And that was a key issue for the commission to consider. I cannot tell you how the commission will vote, although I believe they are certainly leaning towards they are willing to take action at their next meeting where it was scheduled. But the one issue that they just left open was the grandfather clause. And again, I would reiterate it was there has to be activities that are currently lawful and animals that are currently legal to be held.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often has this issue been up in front of the commission? How many times?
Second. This will be the third time, Representative Hill.
And over what period of time?
Within the past year.
So, given that time frame in terms of, I'm trying to understand in terms of what is your suggestion, that this isn't necessary because the commission is going to act imminently, or is this just a kind reminder that the commission's out there and that they may act if they want to? I'm just trying to...
Representative Hill, the commission will take action this month. What I cannot tell you is what the vote will be, but they will take action this month.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Director?
Sorry if I... Rich, it was my understanding that this has been before... It's my understanding this issue has been before the commission for 2 years, and I just heard anecdotally that same response that it'll be voted on this month at least 3 or 4 times.
Representative Deckard, with me I have Dan Edwards, who is our big game biologist, and Dan has been working on this issue extensively. He reminds me the first time we did bring it to the commission was February, and then at the March meeting. Other people may have brought it to the commission through some public testimony, but officially dealing with the issue, we started in the February meeting.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Obawa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When is this next month's meeting?
The meeting is scheduled for the 23rd of April.
23rd of April. Mr. Chair, obviously, we will still be here the 23rd of April, and this has been heard. Is it worthwhile considering perhaps tabling it to see what they do, because that would still allow us time to address it. It's just a thought.
Dan, you're going to pull that mic over closer to you there. Most people are having a hard time hearing back there. What can you add to this issue? Do we need this law if the commission acts? Do we need this bill?
Chair Wells, I believe that if the commission acts and adopts staff's proposal to prohibit the hunting of exotic and game mammals, then the bill would duplicate that effort, I believe.
Representative Wells, I might just add that we believe that the commission has full authority to take the action to enforce the rules that they have and to deal with this issue.
Representative Hill.
What would the effect of any proposed rules be on the one hunting preserve, Clark Couches?
Representative Hill, depending on the method that the commission or the ultimate rules that the commission have, he will certainly be affected by the rules. And again, what we will need to go through with him, depending on which one it has, and we classify on the sheet that I gave you with the commission, we currently have animals classified in a number of categories. For example, domestic or otherwise exempt animals. Those are animals that we have no control over. There are species that are prohibited in this state. There are species that can come into this state, but they are controlled as to how you can hold those. And then there are other species that are essentially uncontrolled. What we would do, we'd have to look at every animal that he has and go through that list, and we feel we have a very good, solid list that we can evaluate each of the animals he may or may not have, and then we can also validate whether that was an animal that was hunted or not hunted at the time the regulation was adopted, whether it be through commission action or whether it be through legislative action.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Byer.
We just talked earlier about a hunting preserve bill that seems to have the commission's full support, yet I guess I don't understand the distinction being made at the department level between a, quote, hunting preserve and a, quote, exotic hunting ranch, or I don't know what you call the operation here. I mean, can you explain the rationale for allowing one and giving it your blessing and at the same time saying the other is totally inappropriate?
Chair Wells, Representative Byer, in statute there is really only one reference to a hunting preserve, and that is in reference to a hunting preserve for game birds, which is the issue that we talked about earlier. So there is no such thing in statute as a hunting preserve for any other type of hunting operation. In fact, we have no licenses or anything like that for that. The genesis between the two, I'm not certain, although under the bird hunting preserve, the birds certainly have opportunity to escape, cover, those sorts of things. The genesis between the two of them, there certainly could be similarities made, but it has just historically been that certainly the bird operations and with the private preserves that have been authorized, they handle them differently, and the sport in that is again detecting the animal and using your dogs, etc. So there can be some similarities, and we've discussed that.
I think for that, we have quite a few people like to testify, and maybe we can get a little clearer idea which way we want to go. See,
thank
Doug,
you.
You're, would you like to come up now? And Doug, Stromberg was with us last time representing Clark Couch's operation and filled us in a little what was going on over there. And we're having a second hearing on this to kind of bring us up to date, because there's been a lot of amendments to come in on this bill since you were here last. And we're just kind of feeling our way along. I don't know really where we're going for sure on this issue, but just to give everybody an opportunity to see the work that's been done on this and give you an opportunity to see what we have. So I guess we'd like to hear from you and your comments. You have a copy of the Pan and Grossed and comments of where you are in relation to also what's going to happen maybe with the commission and how closely this language lines up with some of the language they're playing around with and how this affects you.
Well, I think the bottom line...
You'd like to say your name again.
Doug Stromberg.
is my name. I think the bottom line here is what you're really trying to accomplish. If it's canned hunts, Clark doesn't have canned hunts. He would have been here today, except he now has shingles, okay, which is a nervous disease brought on by extreme stress, which I can guarantee you this, plus the other thing, coupled with regular business, has helped him out with, okay? Canned hunt bills, all the rest of this stuff aside, I really got a question. You can grandfather Clark in, or you can attempt to do that. The only problem is he probably isn't going to go for it, mainly because a grandfather clause is precluded from the portion of the time that the person goes into business, not from 1999, okay? And I dare say when you start dealing with the game department of which animals crossbreed or don't crossbreed, which might affect native game and which doesn't, they don't have a clue which affects native game, okay? Certain deer species do, some don't, okay? The bottom line with what he has right now, sheep, goats, yak, buffalo, whatever, they're not really classified as exotics or game animals, therefore they're excluded, okay? What you're really telling him to do is keep out of the deer business, okay? That's that simple. You keep out of elk, you keep out of this, and you don't have deer, and you don't have that. But my neighbor can be in that business one way or another by charging trespass fees. I have a problem grandfathering him in only from the standpoint is it excludes other people. Okay? There may be other people that want to get into this, and they're just waiting to see how this turns out. I have no idea. All right? The other thing is, when you start looking at it, as the game department stated, that they would determine with each and every animal what should be allowed and not allowed. Well, in the first place, the game department is in charge of the game animals in this state. They're not in charge of somebody's private property or privately held animals, especially when they don't know anything about those animals. On one of the meetings I was at, I mentioned an odd-ad sheep, and we start talking about that. I got more blank looks than you can imagine. They don't even know what an odd-ad sheep is. They have no idea, okay? And yet they're going to make a ruling on it. Clark Couch invited all the people at the commission over to his ranch to go ahead and take a look at it. Now, what you're really talking about here is a group of people making a decision to knock a guy out of business on an asset-based business. This guy is in business, period. That's what he does. And we're talking about making all kinds of rules and regulations of which animals can be hunted and which can't be. And I've never found that to be too advantageous when the people making the decision don't know what the animals are or what they do. I mean, that's really simple. If you're going to take something away, you should know something about it. Okay? And I will also tell you, I've furthered this a little bit further. I have retained an attorney in Louisiana by the name of John Jackson. He's considered the foremost attorney in wildlife management in the world. Okay? I will have a legal opinion written by him for this meeting that's coming up on the 23rd. And I think the commission may be just a hair bit shocked as to what's put in there. This guy's got ivory hunting changed in Africa and everything else. He knows animals exclusively. Okay? If canned hunts is the issue, I think we've defined pretty much what a canned hunt is. Okay? And I don't think there's any question about it. If it's a matter of somebody else being in the animal business, which Clark Couch is and others may want to be, whether it's pheasant or big game or whatever it is, if the object is, does the state or the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have the right to be the only person in that business? And the answer is absolutely not. Why should theirs be excluded when others aren't? Why should theirs not be regulated when theirs aren't? Okay?
Doug, this, the language there on the grandfather's in, evidently that's about the same language that the commission is looking at. And of course it requires that you have necessary permits and that sort of thing. Is that evidently that's going to be a problem?
It's a problem.
Because
I'll pay that
right now.
Because
in this issue of the permitting issue, still arguing over.
Yes, because it still leaves in the game department's hand the right to call the shots. They can say, no, you can't hunt that animal. No, you can hunt this. You got to get a permit.
you can red tape this thing to death. Hunters are not that organized. They're not going to sit there and sign every form and everything else. Clark has taken a simple approach to this. Come over and take a look at what I've got if you're going to take it away. Okay? They have not called him in, although I have had one call from the game department. Would I be willing to sit down and work out the language to do this? Sure I would. And as far as several states in the West having language that precludes this, several states don't. There's over 1,200 game ranches now. They're growing like heck all over the place. California doesn't really have a lot of fence preserves because they use islands. What's the difference? As far as what you feed and don't feed, naturally you have to feed the elk, the deer, bighorn sheep, or exotics in the winter. You have to, or they'll die. It's that simple. Whether they're fenced or not fenced, it makes no difference. And I dare say, when you're talking about if somebody knows where to go for a big animal, of course they do. You should see the network. It's on the internet. You can go any place in the world for any animal you want. It's called networking. It's doing your research. Unfortunately, the guys with the big bucks got the better research. No question about it. But there's also language in places like Alaska that if you fly and hunt the same day, you got a problem. And the guy that they just nailed up there loses his license for 5 years, his airplane, his hunting rights for life, and $250,000 fine. We don't give a murderer that.
Okay.
Well, yeah, there'll be a problem with it because he'll just, I mean, it'll just keep going in the court system. I'm just telling you that.
Yeah.
Okay?
Well, it seems like we're about on the same course. So with this bill is what the commission is working on, and so I guess it's our decision whether we want to move ahead or wait and see what the commission does or what, you know, really I don't know which way we're going.
Yeah, Clark has a provocation license now, okay? It's been in effect before 1993, all right? And he's hunting deer species or anything else, it's legal for him to do so. By all the correspondence that the predecessors to the game department, administrators, commission, and everything else is granted. I mean, there's tons of letters and development that's taken place over the years. So if that's going to be overturned, I think what it needs to be is, do you have all the letters and information that the game department has or that your predecessors have in order to make a reasonable decision based on the verbiage? I mean, he feels one way, I'm going to feel another way, and if you make the decisions based on that, without the research, I think the conclusions may be a little one way or another. Obviously, if any hunting issue goes to public vote, the hunters are going to lose. Hunting is not a popular thing. 7 to 8% of the population hunts. But that's also true of every sport out there. No sport is a majority. Okay? I dare say that golfers kill more people than hunters every year. Pretty wild statement, huh? Take them out of the bars and put them behind the car, how many people they nail? Quite a few.
Okay, thanks, okay. Doug. I have several other people I'd like to get in on this today. Thanks for coming over. I don't know where to start on this list. Kelly, could you bring up two or three of your people and let's kind of go through this? You've kind of sat and listened to all this here today, and kind of come up three at a time. Could you kind of direct traffic with your crew? And cause I don't want to, according to the list, I don't know who is kind of part of your group and who isn't. And, who do we have up here now? We have Kelly and we have
John Snyder and Ann Snyder or Ann Ayla. No.
Andrea?
Ann Ayla.
Yeah, oh, there, I see it. Okay, go ahead.
My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm here to support House Bill 2564. I strongly oppose the amendment before you that grandfathers Clover Creek Ranch. House Bill 2564, in its original form, is designed to stop the cruelty that now exists and prevent future operations from taking root in Oregon. Canned hens are a cruel, unfair, and unsportsmanlike type of practice, one that really does threaten our native wildlife due to ecological damage. As Doug Strongberg says, well, now is the perfect time to ban canned hens because they are growing. Texas has over 500 game ranch or canned hunt operations. Under our existing laws, surveys are already protected from canned hunt operations. This bill would just simply extend coverage to exotic and game mammals, which are the most desired trophy animals. This bill would affect Clover Creek Ranch, but it would also prevent other operations from starting up in Oregon. And I don't mean to make this personal, but I guess I'd ask again, what makes any person so special to give them a monopoly on canned hunts or game ranches, especially when this person has testified at the ODF&W commission meeting to hunting cervids within a fenced-in enclosure, which specifically violates the Oregon cervid rules. And I've attached those rules on the, in the packet. We're about to vote on canned hunts as being against society's values. Clearly, the majority of Oregonians, hunters and non-hunters alike, view this practice as cruel and unfair. For these reasons, I think it would be unwise to grandfather Clark Couch. The polling results, as Representative Deckard stated, from Decision Research even show that 73% of randomly selected Oregonians support a legislative ban on canned hunts. There have already been documented escapes from Clover Creek Ranch. At the March ODF&W Commission meeting, it was noted that exotic feral pigs have been repeatedly found loose in central Oregon. I know we can't document exactly where these ones are coming from, but again, why would we encourage a situation that could lead to problems for our native wildlife? The same fences that are built to keep exotics in keep our native wildlife out. It can be a significant loss of habitat for our native wildlife. In addition, these exotics escape and they compete for food, and they do pose a health risk to our native wildlife. They're certainly not welcome guests. Canned hunts, again, are unsporting and unfair. It's easy to habituate these animals to a point food source. Therefore, really, the amount of acreage is irrelevant. Canned hunts operations artificially combine hundreds of exotic mammals or exotic species together. The animals are limited to the same acreage every day as they attempt to hunt from or attempt to escape from hunters and their guns. This is, of course, if they fear humans still. I think that a confined animal in its unnatural habitat is completely disrespectful to the animal. Again, to grandfather one operation just opens up the doors for others who believe they also deserve the right to the same kind of business. To give one man a monopoly or to give this person a privilege would be unwise. I guess I'd also ask what happens when Clark Couch retires. Can he transfer his business to someone else? Can this business be passed on to a family member? Can he expand his business? What if other fly-by-night organizations say, well, God, we've been in existence, and how do you really document if a business is legitimate, you know, started up in 1999 or before? The majority of Oregonians do not hunt, but we care about these issues. And I think canned hunts paint a very ugly picture of hunting and of hunters, and I just ask you to support the bill.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. We're going to need to move right along here. I'd like to be through with this by 10 o'clock. We're going to have to, you know, if it's all been said, you know, please don't repeat it. So.
I won't. Well, my name is Ann Alott, and I'm really here as I grew up in Lebanon and Albany. I have 8 brothers. They all hunt. My dad hunted. I hunted. We really lived on venison, so I'm not against hunting. I think it, for the people that enjoy doing it, the people that need the meat, I think it's great. But I guess I didn't even realize there was a canned hunt facility in Oregon. It came as a real shock. I've seen quite a few documentaries on Africa where they're done, and I was totally horrified. You know, to cage animals, I don't care how large the cage is. Someone pays their money, they're not going to go away without killing something. And as far as grandfathering in something, I think that is something that is so cruel. I think it'd be immoral to let someone continue doing it. As far as Mr. Clark losing his livelihood or Mr. Couch losing his livelihood, I'm in the wood industry. I saw where 70% of our mills went out of business here because they couldn't afford to buy the logs because the environmentalists shut down the forest. And those people lost their livelihoods. Tens of thousands of workers lost their livelihoods. I mean, you know, what is the difference? And they weren't doing something that was immoral. That's all I have to say.
John?
I'll cut short. I'll just agree with, this is my daughter, and I kind of support her, and I think she says everything quite well.
And she's quite a spitfire.
Oh, yes. I don't agree with her and everything, but I sure do on this. And I'm just absolutely against canned hunts. And I just don't see anything worthwhile about it. That's all I've got to say.
And it is just for the elite, really. I mean, the average person cannot afford to go there and hunt.
Okay, thank you. We have people from the Oregon Humane Society here. There's two or three signed up. We have Wayne Geiger.
Actually, Wayne had to leave.
Okay, you're who?
I'm Susan Mentley. I'm representing the Oregon Humane Society, and for the sake of brevity, I'm going to make it short. I pretty much support the testimony that you just heard. With or without the amendments, we're going to leave that up to you, to your deference. But we certainly oppose the concept of canned hunts for all of the reasons that you've heard. And this is probably the time to make a decision whether or not we're going to allow this industry to take hold and grow in Oregon, or to put a stop to this type of practice.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Any questions? Who do we have here? We have Michelle Blake, Andrea, Patrick. Go ahead, welcome. Nice to have you here today. You've been sitting back there listening to all of this. We'd like to hear your take on it.
Well, I appreciate the time. Whether you'll be done by 10, I don't know, but I do have a couple things to say, and I will try to be brief, but I feel they're important. So my name is Andrea Bauch. I live in Northeast Portland, and I have, I'm glad to be here in front of you today. I've testified several times in front of ODS&W, and I've heard a lot of other testimony as well. And a couple of things have come up that seem pretty important to me that I wanted to point out, and as opposed to repeating the fact that I feel that canned hunting is unethical and is unsportsmanlike. But some of the arguments that were posed in favor of canned hunting is that, especially on Clover Creek Ranch, the argument is proposed that the animals are indeed wild, that manipulating their food source is crazy, that the fact that they have 2,000 acres is enough space. But the discrepancy comes in that I heard another testimony for another hearing the same day in Pendleton that we heard the canned hunting hearing. And one of the people there was talking about elk. He was an elk breeder, and he told a story about how tame his elk are, because he can drive out into the fields where his elk live, and they lay down and they rest and they relax and they don't run away from him. He was saying that these are different from wild elk, and he made a very strong point. Well, previous to that, during the canned hunting testimony or the canned hunting hearing, it was also brought to the attention of the commission that on Clover Creek Ranch there was at least one of the elk that lived on Clover Creek Ranch had escaped. The discrepancy is that Clark Couch claims that all of these animals are indeed wild animals. That elk that escaped had been purchased from the elk breeder who just finished claiming how tame his animals are. So the question comes up, are these animals wild or are they tame? One says that they're wild and one says that they're tame. Regardless of the fact whether they're wild or tame, although this elk probably was tame, they cannot escape. Regardless of anything, someone here said earlier that these animals have every opportunity to escape. On 2,000 acres of rugged land, they do not have every opportunity. They're minus one, the biggest. They're fenced in. They hit the fence, and the 2,000 acres is behind them, period, regardless. They're also enclosed in a small area of predator animals and prey animals. A predator animal is not going to run from a hunter into a prey animal's territory because it's a natural fear. So then you take 2,000 acres and you reduce it by the number of predator animals that are out there. And that prey animal, the one, the small one, the one that's afraid to get eaten, is not going to run into the territory of the predator. So now they have to run away from their natural predator and the hunter on 2,000 acres of fenced-in territory. So we're really reducing it quite a bit when we look at it, perhaps the way that an animal that's kept in that enclosure looks. the idea, one last thing I'd like to say is the idea of grandfathering someone in is a big concern, because it was brought up earlier, we don't know for a fact that there are no other camp hunting facilities out there. Clover Creek is the only one that is known. It is somewhat of a questionable standing. I don't believe that what they do there is ethical. I know that a lot of other people believe that what they do there is unethical. And so I definitely am against, as well, the grandfathering of anyone and giving them a monopoly on a business that we feel is, that the Oregonians are clearly saying they do not support.
Thank you.
I'm Patrick.
Yeah, Patrick Buckley.
Yes, thanks, Chairman Wells. I'll be real brief. I just believe that camp hunting is unethical and unsportsmanlike, and I want to go against the concept of grandfathering, because I believe it creates a monopoly, and I don't think that's a good idea for us here in Oregon. And that's it. Just want to reiterate what everybody else has said.
Thank you.
I know you want to be brief.
Nice to have
Chair
you.
Chair Wells, if you don't mind, one last comment. As a constituent and a resident of the state of Oregon, with all due respect, I feel that we do have important things to say, regardless of whether I'm a hunter or not, regardless of where I live. I've come down here to testify today. I have things that I feel are important and relevant. Other people have been given fair game, fair chance to speak. It's a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit offensive to feel like we have to hurry and be looking at the clock when we've come here, clearly with the intention to practice what our government allows us to practice, and that is to speak to the people that we've elected to represent us. So I hope that other people that come up here won't feel as rushed and as uncomfortable as I have. Thank you.
I appreciate those comments. Unfortunately, that's kind of, we run under a time constraint, and we have a long list like this, and it's hard for me to manage the time when the other people in front of you maybe talk longer than they should have, and so then I'm trying to adjust the time, and we have to be on the floor at 10:30, and we have one other issue we have to deal with. So we're just, you know, we just have a time constraint, unfortunately. We have Chuck Woolsey. You like to come on up. You've been around here before. Let's see, who am I missing? We have Michelle Blake. She left. Andrea Dumas. You like to come on up? I believe is that everyone that was signed up on the list? Did I miss anyone? Chuck, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Wells.
I've been sitting back there trying to hear this morning.
Yeah. Hearing aids aren't perfect.
Yes.
But, Chairman Wells, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I'm Chuck Woosley of Corvallis, Oregon, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you again on House Bill 2564. As I mentioned in your previous hearing, I certainly agree with the concept of the bill. And I agree with Amendments 1 and 3 that you are considering here today, as I understand them to be anyway. I think they are improvements. But I am very definitely against the grandfathering in of any of the existing ranches at this time. Yes, it's sad to tell a person that's been in operation for 1 year or 40 years that they can no longer operate. But we have some real good parallels here to go along with that, too, and that is Oregon's land use laws or the timber industry that is not permitted to harvest your timber because of the spotted owl situation and that. So there are preceding cases for this. And I think with the hazards that bringing in these exotic animals present to our native wildlife, I think really justifies that we do not permit that. There's possibility of genetic degradation, disease spreading, parasite spreading, such, because the fences of these operations can be breached. And Mr. Couch testified at the Pendleton Commission meeting that his fences had been cut and that his fences had been breached. One of his elk was killed 50 miles from the operation there. Had that been a diseased elk, our native herds could be in deep trouble. And once those diseases, bovine tuberculosis, bovine brucellosis, and now chronic wasting disease that is in Colorado and Wyoming. Once those diseases are out there in our free-roaming wildlife, it's impossible to control them and get them under check. So I know, and I think there's some real good ethical and philosophical reasons too, but the biological ones are the important ones.
Thank you, Chuck. Nice to have you here today. Let's see. Go ahead. You're Andrea.
Yes, good morning. I'm Andrea Dumas, and I am here as one of those 73% of Oregonians who are in favor of such a ban. I won't go into great detail, as I think it's been very well covered, but I would like to say a couple of things. One, I am sorry about Mr. Couch's shingles brought on by stress. My mother suffered with that, and it was quite traumatic. However, I would be interested to know whether these animals might suffer from that same sort of problem and the stress of being in those confined. So maybe he has some sympathy right at home. In addition, I did hear earlier testimony regarding the fact that it would be wrong to, with the grandfather clause, it would be wrong to create a situation where a private citizen would be denied the opportunity to have this kind of business and give a monopoly to the state. I think we've long been accustomed to the OLCC having a monopoly on selling liquor in this state, and we've all gotten used to that idea as well. So I would strongly urge you not to grandfather in any provision and support this bill. I think staining Oregon with the blood of these animals which are confined is wrong, and I think it's certainly beneath us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We need to move along on, because we have to deal with the notorious wool assessment bill before we leave here today.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Decker,
if I could make a suggestion that we move into work session and have a vote on the amendments. I think we've heard this issue and have an up or down vote on the amendments as to where the committee is.
I don't think I'm going to do that now. I think I want to discuss this bill some more. I'm going to close the hearing on this bill. With that, I'm going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 626.
Mr. Chair, is this a hearing or a work session?
Work session on 626.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could you open up the hearing on the bill you voted on for purposes of allowing me to vote?
Oh, yes. I'm going to close the work session on 626 and reopen the hearing on a work session on House Bill 3381 for the purpose of allowing Representative Ubalov to vote.
This is 3381, correct?
Yeah, 3381.
I vote.
Samantha?
Yes.
Thank you. Closes the work session on 3381. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 626. Where we are on this, after we moved this bill out with two dissenting votes, Representative Beyer and Representative Ubalov, and that's
three.
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 I was there too.
Oh, okay. And the speaker came to me and had some concerns about this. There seemed to be still a lot of unsettled issues as far as agreement within the industry is where they were going, and asked me to. So we stopped the bill before it got to the floor, and so we need a motion to suspend the rules for reconsidering the vote. We need that motion first.
So moved.
Representative Beyer moves to suspend the rules, reconsider the vote on 626. Is any discussion on the motion? So moved. Now we need the rule has been suspended. Now we need a motion to reconsider the vote.
So moved.
It needs to come from the surveillance.
Oh, then I can't move.
You prevail.
You need a motion to.
Yeah, I need a motion to reconsider.
So did you and me and him.
Go ahead, Representative Thompson.
like to make a motion to reconsider
the vote that we made on Senate Bill 626.
626.
Discussion. Motion passed.
Well, I object.
Oh, and I object.
We're going to.
The bill is back in front of us.
Okay, well, I'm just voicing my objection.
Okay, we have two objections. You didn't want to reconsider. You're objecting to reconsider.
I object to reconsideration.
Okay.
So there's three objections.
Three objections. Motion still.
Where's the third?
One, two, three, four.
Yeah.
Four. You got three. Where are we, Representative Hill?
Two, three.
Only have four. It's four to three.
Five to three.
Okay.
So it's before us as amended?
Okay, it's before us. Now we have to decide what we're going to do with this bill. First, Rich. Rich, would you like to come up and tell us what you'd like to have us do with this bill? Last night he left my office. He went out. Was going to talk to some of you and get back. Some of his commission people are here, and we can let's hear from him. Really, what we'd like to do.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Rich.
Pull the mic, there, Rich.
And I can certainly say that I would probably prefer to be somewhere else rather than right here this morning. There's been a lot of discussion with respect to this bill, but I think I would strongly encourage the committee to keep in mind this measure is before you, and it grants the Sheep Commission the authority to increase assessments on wool. That's all the bill does. In light of concerns, commission members and the association developed amendments to suggest and require or restrict the growth of assessments. And that was brought forth in an effort to address those concerns. I think the commission is very, very much aware of the concerns with this measure. I think the commission is a very conservative body. I don't think they act without forethought, concern for the industry, and a lot of care and attention to detail. There were discussions during the first hearing and work session that the commission should look at whether the assessment schedule or system is equitable, and I would encourage first the committee to move the bill forward and direct the commission, and I've heard that loud and clear, is direct the commission during the interim to take a look at the method of assessment to find out if it is equitable. If there are other means for assessments, can we go from a assessment based on wool to a per head basis? But I think the bill, as amended, is an attempt by the proponents to address the concerns, and I would very much encourage your movement of the bill forward.
Where's my wisdom on this committee? Representative Rubelong?
I'm not responding because I'm wisdom, but I'm not responding because I do have a couple comments. I was one of the ones that voted no on this, and my no vote really did not reflect whether or not I agreed on the increase. We've had many of the farming industries here before us who commissions that increase their dues on themselves because they use them for things they all agree need to be done, whether it be marketing or whatever. And but my no vote was because I was extremely concerned about what I perceive from testimony and people, the disarray among the industry. And I don't think an industry can survive with that kind of disarray. And that's what my no vote was about. As I think I said when I voted no, I was going to do a little bit more investigation, and I did, and I still feel, and the input I received is there is disarray. However, that an assessment, an increase, is necessary to whether this particular one, the way to go is right or not. But there is a need for an increase if you want to accomplish for the industry what is proposed. So at this time, I will vote yes for it. But I would strongly, and I underline strongly, suggest that the commission in the industry sit down and talk about, I wouldn't just say, oh, well, it's passed, I don't have to worry anymore, and shine it on, that they need to sit down and discuss among themselves how they go about doing this, what actually the assessment should be against, what's fair to the whole industry. Because if something would come back to me like this, I was just saying the next term I won't be here, but I would be strong, I would vote a solid no if I found they didn't get together in the interim. And so I would change my vote to yes at this point, but with the comments that I've made, given the amendments, I would vote yes.
Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I've heard both sides of this issue, came to my office, and there's one thing that I was interested in, and that was where they spent their money. And I received a breakdown of some of the things that they're spending their money on, their promotions of fare boosts, newsletters to the industry, 4-H awards, things that donations to lambs and pelts, youth programs, and promotions for county lamb and wool shows. These are all positive things that are good signs in the industry. And I realize there's a frustration when you increase any fee when you're in an industry that's in a depressed stage. But the only way you get out of it is by promotions. And so I'll stick with my yes vote and try to move it on. One thing that worries me is I heard a rumor that some of this money went toward lobbying. And I went out and asked for some research on it, and I can't see where there's any of this money that winds up in lobbying hands.
Well, as I would understand their budget, part of it goes back to the Oregon Sheep Growers Association, and that's the people who hire Rich, and he does their public he does their public relations for them.
Right. But it's not like for an increase for lobbying fees or some of the rumors that I heard around here. Just didn't fit.
Representative Hill, where are you going to be on this thing?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess my no vote came from the inability of the commission to look at alternatives to the wool in terms of wool prices are depressed. Nobody's buying wool. We had that testimony, so there's not going to be any money collected. And so it didn't make much sense to me why they were looking to increase the assessment on a product that they couldn't collect the money on because nobody's purchasing it, rather than looking at alternatives to the head tax and that. And, you know, and I understand in terms of, gosh, it's difficult. They've never gone there, but there's other industries who do that in this state, and they don't have a problem with that. And so my no vote was based on a frustration in terms of their unwillingness to look at alternatives. I wasn't asking to impose the task. I was just looking to give them that alternative. I think in terms of that would be a good thing. And perhaps one of the ways we get out of this is to put a sunset clause on it so they have to come back next session, whether we want to or not. To address the issues in terms of how they've worked within this community to solve their problems in terms of how they're going to do it. in terms of, I'm looking to give them the best number of tools to go forward, and I think they can decide whether they think a head tax is better than a wool tax, but give them that opportunity and then have them come back and say to us, did it work or didn't it work, or it worked or it didn't. So, I mean, if the bill's in its present state, I think I would still vote no. But I think it's short-sighted in terms of how it's going to solve the problems.
Representative Beyer, you were a no vote. Or are you still a no vote on this issue?
Mr. Chair, when I voted no before, I made the statement that if we got rid of subsection 2 of section 2 in the proposed amendment, I would could very strongly then consider voting yes, but a sunset would do the same thing, I guess. It would force the issue back in front of the this body in 2 years.
Subsection 2 allowed the 0.5% per year.
The escalator.
The escalator on up through there.
But not for July 2000, so a year sunset would kind of do that same thing.
Yeah, sunset would do the same thing.
How would a sunset affect this operation? That'd allow you to raise it for 1 year if you're going to raise it, and then it'd have to go back. You'd have to force it back here in front of this body in 1 year or 2 years from now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson.
I'd oppose a sunset like this. I mean, if the industry wants to reduce itself in its fees, it can always reduce itself in fees internally. This is only a cap.
But, Mr. Chair.
Representative Overlong.
I think that Representative Hill was addressing what happened to the bill. This bill only allows an increase in fee on wool. And one of the things that I understood Representative Hill to be addressing is not only do they need to work as an industry to get together, but to think of other options to raise money, and that's what they could do within the 2 years. Under this bill, Representative Thompson, they could not raise it any other means except on the wool.
Well, nobody's buying wool, so they're not going to collect
them. Nobody's buying wool. Can I keep it?
But, Mr. Chair, I guess, you know, the bill moved out once on a vote. If the votes are on the House floor, I don't know why it's back in front of us. Why it's back here is because we had 3 no votes, and we had a group of people who were lobbying the bill, against the bill very strongly. And the speaker came to me and wanted to know what was going on with this bill, why there was so much dirt being kicked up out there. And here we bring it to floor with 3 no votes. And she didn't want a floor battle on this issue. And I had some of our fellow members that came to me and said their farm bureaus had meetings in the meantime when we moved it out and had voted not to support the bill, their county farm bureaus. And so they were getting a little bit nervous of cover on which way they should go. And I said, fine, let's bring the bill back. We don't have to even do anything today. You know, we can just sit on this. It's a Senate bill, and until we can get some direction. But I don't think the speaker wants a floor battle on
point of clarification.
Representative.
This bill was passed out. How do you draw a bill back to committee after it's passed out?
What happened today is the rule. We considered our vote that was passed out.
No, but I thought that once, this is a point of clarification, once we passed it out, I mean, even then, I thought it was gone from this committee. How did we ever even get it back in front of the committee?
Representative Hill,
Representative Thompson, we just suspended the rules.
But isn't there a...
And we considered the vote by which we sent it out to the floor.
Yeah.
But You were on
the... I understand that. But my question is, once we passed it out, I thought it went to the speaker's desk. Did
we
the speaker
it,
send
got
it back?
We got it before it went to the speaker's desk.
Before it went to the clerk's desk.
How many hours do we have before that happens? Isn't there a time limit on this?
We did it 15 minutes before it goes to go there. That's when the speaker came and talked to me and says, does this thing go to the clerk's desk, or are we going to let it go, or should we bring it back?
Mr. Chair, members, there is a 3-day requirement.
That's what I was looking for.
For us to do our work to draw.
So we're still inside the time frame.
Yes. Okay, that's what I was looking for. If we'd have waited, it had to go onto the floor and have a motion. So we pulled it back without the motion. Okay. So,
Mr. Chair, question.
President Krupp.
What do we have to do in this committee to get a unanimous vote?
I don't know that we have to have a unanimous vote on this bill. We can move it out without a unanimous vote, but we had three people against this bill last time, and I think what we need to have is the fact that we're not going to have a bunch of county farm bureaus and other people that aren't part of the Sheep Growers Association agreement and start lobbying every member on the floor, and the speaker sends this out, or it's not going to sit very well.
But we can't stop the farm bureaus. I mean, they can lobby.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Jose Thompson.
That is one of the purposes of this process, is to be able to handle contentious issues, and that we have several different stages we go through so that these contentious issues get resolved. And if they're, I mean, we have one of them here that's there, and I think that we're doing an injustice to the process. It's only because of the process that it's got this far, and if she lives, she lives. If she dies, she dies.
Is that the way we want to go? Is that the consensus of the committee?
Yeah, send it out. Mr. Chair, I guess I would, there's many other contentious bills in this building that don't get unanimous support, but normally the proponents of such bill know the life of the expectancy of the bill before it gets to the floor. And I guess if someone has a reasonable expectation this bill will get 31 votes on the floor, it should go back to the floor. If they don't, it probably should lay right where it is.
How do you determine that ahead of time?
You count.
You want to send it to the floor? That's what you want to do it?
Mr. Chair, again, I would encourage the committee to move it forth. I believe the commission, the association, has heard from the committee very, very clearly to take a look at the system and look at the equitability associated with that system, and I believe very sincerely that the commission and the association will take a look at the system during the next year or two.
Mr. Chair, President Hill, I'd also note that we did amend it in the House, therefore the option arrives after it returns to the Senate is to bring it to a conference committee where if there are any residual issues could be hammered out in a sheep-based conference committee.
Mr. Chair,
we have a motion.
By voting, but I will also remember, if you vote, you
have amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Crummell moves Senate Bill 626 to the floor again. as amended. Samantha, call the roll, please.
Chair Long?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Erbaugh?
Yes.
Representative Byer?
No.
Representative Hill?
No.
Representative Decker?
Yes.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Krupp?
Yes.
Representative Snow?
Yes.
Senate Bill 626 going to the floor. Not coming back this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Those in the hearing on Senate Bill 626. Thursday, we're having a hearing on the, I call it the son of 64, but it's a new proposal. It will be a proposed initiative to deal with the harvest.